the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good morning again. I'm sorry you've had a lot of me this morning. I do apologise for that. If you're here for the first time, just an update of where we are, because you land with us and we're in the middle of a series. Hopefully it doesn't come as a shock to you, but as we're in the lead up to Easter, we're having a little think about a series on the cross. And now, if you are relatively new to Christianity or church at all, at Belmont Chapel, we firmly believe in this book. We believe it's got something to say. So each week we look at it. And we also believe that the two questions, who is Jesus and why did he die, are more important questions than you will face today or at any point in time in the future. You see, unlike any other religion, Christianity, it's not a system of theory, it's not a philosophy, it's not an ideology. It is based on a person. Christianity is based on Jesus Christ and the fact of his death and his resurrection. And the whole of human history and the whole of the Bible point towards the moment where Jesus sheds his blood on the cross for you, for me, and for the whole world. And so that's why we're having this five-part series leading up to Easter. Now, we're on part three, bang in the middle of it. And the series is based on Matthew's accounts of the events leading up to Jesus Christ's death. Now, we are going to use snippets from other Gospels just to try and help us fully understand what was happening 2,000 years ago. And the passage that Joan's going to read for us in a moment is, and Paul has alluded to, is on page 944. Please grab a Bible or scroll to it, because we'll hold quite closely to this morning. Now, I know you shouldn't apologise when you're about to start speaking, but I'm going to. In this passage, there is so much going on. So if you feel at the end of this shortchanged, please, please forgive me. Here's why. There are characters galore in these 26 verses. There are chief priests. There's a terrorist. There's a judge who has an interfering wife. There is a man who commits suicide. There is the king of the world. In addition, there is the most monumental miscarriage of justice. There is sadness. There is tragedy. There is scheming and plotting. There is innocence and guilt. There is greed and envy. There is cowardice. And there is a scandalous lack of courage and integrity. Now, I could carry on. But straight away, please don't let anybody ever tell you this book is dull. If they're telling you that, they have not read it. It is not dull. There is so much going on. I need to boil it down as much as possible. So I just have one question this morning, which I want us to answer. And just look for it as Joan reads it to us now. See if you can spot it. The question is this. Who's in charge? Who is in charge?
Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. When Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that Jesus was condemned, he was seized with remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. "That's your responsibility." So Judas threw the money into the temple and left, and then went away and hanged himself. The chief priests picked up the coins and said, "It is against the law to put this into the treasury, since it is blood money." So they decided to use the money to buy the potter's field as a burial place for foreigners. That is why it has been called the Field of Blood to this day. Then what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. They took the 30 pieces of silver, the price set on him by the people of Israel, and they used them to buy the potter's field, as the Lord commanded me. Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," replied Jesus. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, "Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?" But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor. Now it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a well-known prisoner whose name was Jesus Barabbas. So when the crowd had gathered, Pilate asked, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who is called the Messiah?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him a message, "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I have suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus executed. "Which of these two do you want me to release to you?" asked the governor. "Barabbas," they answered. "What shall I do then with Jesus, who is called the Messiah?" Pilate asked. They answered, "Crucify him." "Why, what crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." When Pilate saw that he was getting nowhere, but that instead an uproar was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It is your responsibility." All the people answered, "His blood is on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them. But he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified.
Let's pray. Heavenly Father, not much time, but the most incredible dramatic reading. Father, please help us to understand these verses in these next few minutes. Please help us to realize who is in charge and who's always in charge, and to live as a result of that, we pray. Amen. Will you have a look at this picture? This is my family. And if I was to ask you the question, who is in charge? Oh, don't laugh already. If you didn't know me, you would probably say one of the adults. Nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is it's my daughter who is pulling the strings most of the time in our household. Even though she is the youngest, she has this incredible ability to get what she wants. Now, in my work as a teacher, I will regularly, and tomorrow morning I'll do it, I'll stand in front of 1,000 teenagers. And they will fall silent for me, and they will do what I want generally. I come home and I get bossed around by a 9-year-old girl. There is something incredibly wrong. Often at times, it's not what you always think is going on, is actually going on. If the people on the street of Exeter read this passage now, and they were asked the question, who's in charge, I genuinely don't think they'd get the right answer. There are loads of suspects here, and we don't have time to go through all of them. I'm picking on four this morning who I think could be in charge in this passage. Firstly, as at the start of the passage, it could easily be Judas. It could be the chief priests are in charge. It could be Pilate. Or however, this will sound ridiculous, however ridiculous it may sound, could it possibly be Jesus who is the one who is destined to die? Now, let's just have a look at them in turn. And please keep that passage open with you. Let's just have a look at Judas, because when Si spoke to us a couple of weeks ago, when we left the series, for all intents and purposes, it looks like Judas is in charge, doesn't it? Judas is the one who's in control. He's holding the aces. He's betrayed Jesus. He has led the authorities to him. He's earned his 30 pieces of silver. Things are going very, very well for Judas. Big twist. You spot it at the start of this passage, starting verse 3. Judas, he is not in charge. No, it's not him. Do you see how quickly things unravel in this passage? There are 31,102 verses in the entire Bible. Verses 3 to 5 are three of the most tragic you will ever read. Look what happens to Judas, how quickly it goes wrong. Verse 3, see that phrase in the middle? He is seized with remorse. Immediately, this man who is a follower of Jesus, he's lost his peace. But it gets worse. He realizes that he's sinned, and actually his happiness has gone. He loses his joy. And as well as losing his joy, he realizes he's betrayed Jesus. He's lost his allegiance to Jesus. It's spiraling and spiraling until we read the tragedy of verse 5, when Judas loses his life. It is a tragic start to this passage, isn't it? Someone who is a committed follower of Jesus, someone who is in beautiful communion with Jesus so many times in his life, has just spiraled completely out of control. There's no way that Judas is in charge in this scenario. So if it's not Judas, surely it's those guys next. It's the chief priests and the elders. They are the people who've got to be in charge here in this astonishing scenario. It's clear, isn't it? They're desperate to get rid of him. Did you spot that as Joan read it to us, verses 1 and 2? They've gathered together early in the morning. They've perfected their plan. They've tied Jesus up and they've handed him over to Pilate. But they're not done, are they? Verse 12, they're piping up again. Have a look. Oh, like a dog with a bone, giving it to Pilate, accusing Jesus. And verse 20, even when we're outside the courtroom now, they're still at it, persuading the crowds to ask for Barabbas instead of Jesus. They just keep going. But I suppose the big question is, why? Why are they so keen to get rid of Jesus? What has Jesus done which is bothering them so, so much? Well, previously in the Gospels, if you know anything about the life of Jesus, he's developed a rather large and at times volatile following among the people. He is the talk of the town. And we first get an indication of what the chief priests ultimately want to do in John 11. Here's the verses from John 11, 47, 48. So they've gathered together as the Sanhedrin, the chief priests and the Pharisees. Here is this man Jesus performing many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. That's their real concern. Jesus isn't some sort of military threat to them. They are just bothered about losing everything. Jesus isn't going to harm them, but he could take things from them. So we've got to get rid of them, rid of Jesus. So yes, in one sense, these people are in charge, aren't they? Because they seem to be manipulating the whole scenario. But it's an absolute emphatic no in another sense. They are plotting Jesus' death. But if you were at the recent evening with comedian James Carey, you'll have heard him point out that the plan of the chief priests is possibly the most ridiculous plan that has ever been conceived by any human being ever. That's a big statement. But why? Why do I say that? Well, those verses in John chapter 11 come right after the moment that Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead. You think about that for a moment. Just a second. The chief priests decide to kill Jesus after seeing him raise Lazarus from the dead. It's bonkers, isn't it? What should we do with the one who brings people back to life? What can we do with this Jesus guy who seems to have power over death? Let's kill him. It's almost like Dad's Army, Chuckle Brothers, and Laurel and Hardy got in a room and came up with a plan. This plan is destined to fail. If Jesus is master over death, don't think that killing him will stop him. It's a ridiculous idea. If you have read the Passion narratives, which are the gospel accounts of the end of Jesus' life as he comes towards his death, it really can feel like the chief priests are the ultimate puppet masters. They're the ones who are pulling the strings, moving the pieces. They're not. Not at all. Killing Jesus is a ridiculous plan because he's just shown that Jesus has power over death. And it's also a ridiculous plan because they can't actually put it into place. I don't know if you know this, but the Sanhedrin, that's the chief priests and the elders, they don't have the power to pass a death sentence. In many cases, they are empowered, but for capital cases, they can't do it. They need the confirmation of a Roman procurator. Consequently, as soon as they're able to, right at the start of this passage, we see them doing this, they hand Jesus over to Pilate, who is the governor appointed by Rome, so that they can try and persuade him to put Jesus to death. So Judas isn't in charge, and the chief priests, they're not in charge. So surely it's the next guy. Surely it's the big dog. Surely it's governor and sixth Roman procurator to serve in Judea, Pilate. He's got to be in charge, hasn't he? Well, if you know anything about Pilate, he was a minor Roman official who was actually a long way from home. And he was frequently accused of being someone who was heavy-handed or having ill-considered judgments. But that shouldn't come as a surprise, to be honest, because Pilate's job was a massive headache. No one, I promise you, no one in this room would want Pilate's job. No one in Pilate's line of work wanted to end up in the Middle East. He'd have been an ambitious man, but he had a very delicate challenge. You see, he's got to keep these chief priests on side, but he can't keep them too close. He's got to keep them at a distance. There's also zealot freedom fighters who are out there. There are nationalist Pharisees. There are isolationist Essenes. There are so many different factions that he has to keep a lid on. All these ones over here, they all agree about hating Rome, but it's all kicking off. If you thought negotiating Brexit was tough, you just try being in Pilate's shoes. It was a difficult job. But however tough the job was, Pilate wasn't the nicest individual. That's clear in the Gospels. Luke 13, we learn about people telling Jesus that Pilate has had a group of pilgrims from Galilee at worship killed. We also learn later that Pilate sequestered money to build an aqueduct, sequestered money from the temple. Now, Israel would say he stole it. Some people kicked off. Pilate had them killed as well. Pilate's not a nice man. Philo said this about him. Pilate's rule was marked by bribery, insults, robbery, supreme cruelty, executions without a trial, and a furious, vindictive temper. This is not the man you want to meet down a back alley or on a bad day. Pilate is a challenging individual, and Jesus is brought before him. And when Jesus is brought before Pilate, the chief priests have done their work craftily, sneakily, slyly, and they bring to Jesus, they bring a charge before Jesus. Now, we don't get it in this gospel here, the full charge. We do get it in Luke's gospel. So as Jesus is brought before Pilate, the chief priests bring their charge against him. We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payments of taxes to Caesar, and he claims to be Messiah, a king. Now, that is just how the game is played. Please, can I assure you, the devious chief priests are not concerned with money. They do not want to help Caesar squeeze more money out of Israel. That's a bit like Momentum, the organization that supports Labour Party, raising money for the Conservative Party. It's not going to happen. This is not about money. The chief priests don't want more taxes paid to Caesar. They're just trying to put pressure on Pilate. We want you to do what we want you to do, Pilate. Do you know what, Pilate? Caesar's not going to be happy with this guy, Jesus. You're going to have to kill him. He's going to cause trouble. If you don't do something about it, we're all going to be in trouble. So what does Pilate do? Well, initially, Pilate doesn't do what the chief priests are trying to get him to do. Why? Well, firstly, the political game. Pilate never does what the chief priests tell him to do straight away. It's about keeping them at arm's distance. But secondly, Pilate doesn't do what they ask him to do because it's clear, isn't it, he doesn't think he's guilty. Have a look at verse 18. He knows it's out of envy that the chief priests have handed him over to them. And so we can see right through this episode, I think, Pilate is pretty bemused by all that's going on. And I don't know, again, if you've read the accounts, when I read it, I feel Pilate wriggling. Do you feel him squirming? It feels like an MP trying to explain their tax expenses. It just feels wriggle and squirm. He doesn't want to do what the chief priests want him to do. He doesn't want to be in trouble with the crowds, but he doesn't think that Jesus is guilty. So he squirms and he squirms and he wriggles until he realizes that he has one more card to play. And the card's quite a well-known card to play because he knows he can escape the responsibility of a decision through this time-honored custom of releasing a prisoner amid a time of general rejoicing. So he offers the crowd the choice. Do you want Jesus or do you want Barabbas? Now, Barabbas is a violent man who has been convicted of murder. Jesus is not. It's an obvious choice, isn't it? You'd have thought. Well, it's not as obvious for the crowd because actually in Mark and Luke's gospel, it tells us that Barabbas has been involved in riots. He's been involved against movements against Rome. John uses the word lestes, which tells us that Barabbas would be regarded as in the crowd as a patriot. He's a freedom fighter. So the crowd are there going, do we want this passive Messiah, Jesus Christ? Or do we want someone who might stand up and murder a few Romans? And with the help of the chief priest, verse 20, they go, we want Barabbas. And it's a terrible, terrible moment as Jesus goes to the cross. Barabbas goes free. Jesus goes to his death. You see, it may look like Pilate's in charge, but Pilate has completely ignored his conscience, and he has done the one thing that judges should never, ever, ever do. He has ignored justice. The guilty one goes free, And the innocent one heads to the cross. Judas isn't in charge. The chief priests are not in charge, and Pilate's not in charge. Which leaves, well, on the face of it, the unthinkable. It leaves Jesus. Is Jesus really in charge in this situation? And the answer to that question is a resounding and emphatic yes. If you remember one thing this morning, please will you remember this? Jesus Christ always has been, and he always will be, in charge. Jesus Christ was in charge at the beginning of time, and he will be in charge at the end of time. He was in charge in the manger. He was in charge in the temple. He was in charge as a carpenter. He was in charge in the Garden of the Gethsemane at the start of this series. He was in charge before the Sanhedrin. He's in charge right now, and he's in charge on Good Friday and Easter Sunday and the day that he returns. Jesus Christ is in charge in these final hours. I mentioned right at the start of this week, this series, that you'll see littered through this series, Jesus has so many get-outs. He could play his get-out-of-the-cross-free card at any moment, or he could shout, I'm the Son of God, get me out of here. He doesn't do it. Have you seen all the opportunities that Jesus has had? In the Garden of Gethsemane, he could run away. He doesn't. He gets on his hands and knees, and he prays to the Father. He says, this is so difficult. I don't want to face this cup of suffering. Is there another thing we can do? But not my will be done, yours be done, says Jesus in the garden. Then it goes on, doesn't it, after the garden, the moment of arrest when Judas kisses Jesus and he's arrested. Jesus could do whatever he wants. Jesus could zap him. Jesus could call down thousands of angels. Jesus could stop this at any moment with his power. He doesn't. He surrenders. Then he's in front of the Sanhedrin, the court that Simon helped us think about. He could tell half-truths. He could tell my little fibs, little lies. He doesn't. Jesus is in charge. And we see this ultimate moment. The big moment is verse 11 in this passage. It's the really, really big moment. He stands in front of Pilate. All he's got to do is stay quiet. Jesus, don't say anything now and you'll be okay. You'll get out of this. Pilate says, are you the king of the Jews? But once again, Jesus doesn't deviate from the plan. You've said so. The NIV translates that verse as what Jesus says as yes, it's as you say. Those are amazing words, because by answering that question in the way that he does, Jesus Christ pronounces his own death sentence. The chief priests are desperately trying to get to kill Jesus, but Jesus pronounces his death sentence right there. And he does so because he's in charge. And the timing of this makes that even more certain. If you think about the life of Jesus, Jesus has kept this till this moment. At virtually any other moment in his life, there would have been hundreds of thousands who would have followed him. Imagine him after he's fed the 5,000. Here I am. They'd have all gone over the hill for him. Imagine him on the Sermon on the Mount with them all captivated. They've all gone and followed him. But the moment that Jesus says this is the moment that he is completely alone. Jesus is completely in charge in this situation. John 10:18. Jesus says, no one takes my life from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. Judas isn't in charge. The chief priests are not in charge. Pilate is not in charge. Jesus Christ is the boss, and he is in control, even in the most unlikely of situations. And please remember that in your situation, your life right now. Be it your home, your marriage, your relationship, your singleness, your work, your leisure, your church, Jesus is in charge. We live in a world that feels hopelessly out of control, hopelessly confused and lost, but please be under no illusions. Jesus is in control. Jesus is the boss. He came to earth 2,000 years ago. He died and he rose again, and one day he will return. I need to close now, but just as we close, I just want to focus on one little bit, because it's a detail that only appears in Matthew's gospel about this scene, and it's subtle. Blink and you'll miss it. And I think it's really important. See, there's one character in the passage that we haven't talked about a great deal, and that was the terrorist called Barabbas. Well, that's how we call him, don't we? If you ask people in the street, it's Barabbas, isn't it? Jesus and Barabbas. Well, yeah, that is his name, but actually, that's quite a strange name, actually, Jesus Barabbas. It's a bit of an odd one. I don't know if you know where this name comes from, but it comes from two words, Barabbas. The first bit, bar, that means son. And the second bit, Abba, you're probably more familiar with. Abba means father. So when you put those words together, it means that Barabbas is a son of the father. That's ridiculous, isn't it? If you think about that, you wouldn't call your child son of the father. That doesn't make any sense. And because everybody at some level is a son of a father. Barabbas must be this guy's surname, otherwise it's completely meaningless. I wonder what this guy's first name is. Have a look at verse 16. The chap that we know as Barabbas is actually called Jesus Barabbas. And I hope the irony is not lost on you here. I'll try and show it to you as we close. The crowd are not presented with one Jesus. The crowd are presented with two Jesuses. But you see, what is even more ironic is, and there are endless ironies here, and I don't have time to go through them all, but both of these Jesuses are sons of the Father. See, Jesus Barabbas, that's what his name means, son of the Father, but they're also presented with Jesus, the Son of God. And it carries on. They are both the same, but they couldn't be more different. One rules by taking the lives of others. One of them gives his life. One of them wants to overthrow the king. One of them is the rightful and the true king. One is guilty and is going to be set free. And one is innocent, but is going to go to the cross. Jesus is going to be killed for the kind of crime that the man who gets set free actually committed. The ironies go on. Jesus, as we'll see in the coming weeks, literally takes Barabbas' punishment for him. Jesus even marched to his death as Barabbas would have. Jesus marched willingly. He marched quietly, as we're going to see. And yet it's not because he is lost. Jesus Christ has not been outsmarted. We are not on plan B. This is not a mistake. This is not an accident. Jesus Christ, the true Son of God, takes the place of Jesus Barabbas. Someone once said to me that when you read the Bible, see if you can spot yourself in the passage. I wonder who you are in this passage. You might be the crowd. You might be someone who's just a bit unimpressed by this Jesus. If you are, please, I urge you, have another look. Come along to one of our courses. Come along anytime. Come along every Sunday. This Jesus will transform your life. You might be the chief priest. You might be someone who is actively undermining Jesus. Again, I'd urge you to reconsider that. You might be Pilate. You might be someone who continually hears about the good news of Jesus Christ, but you just sit on the fence. Or you might be Barabbas. You might be Barabbas. You see, I see myself in Barabbas. See, the amazing thing about the death of Jesus Christ is that he didn't just die in Barabbas's place. His death can set you and me free too. This person's death means that I can get all these things. You see, we're all set to die one day. All of us. And although we've turned our back on God, even though we're supposed to honor him in this life, the maker and the creator of the world, even though we've turned our back on him and we're guilty, just like Barabbas was, it's possible for us to know forgiveness. You see, the great news is if you trust in Jesus, if you follow him, then Jesus goes to the cross in your place. That's what happens. If you follow him, Jesus Christ goes there for you. And he gets what you deserve, and you get what he deserves. It's the greatest exchange in the whole of history. Jesus Christ gave up his life so that you can have life. Please be under no illusions. This was not a mistake. It wasn't an accident. It's not plan B. Jesus Christ is always, always in control. For our sake, God made Jesus to be sin who knew no sin, so that in Jesus we might become the righteousness of God.